Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. This week on the HR Power Hour, our guest is Kevin Hancock, a president of Hancock Lumber. He has a new book called Not For Sale, Finding Center in the Land of Crazy Horse. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. And today we're talking with the president of Hancock Lumber, Kevin Hancock. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Yes. Well, you know, obviously we're going to talk about your new book titled Not For Sale. And, you know, that's what we're here about. But first, I'd love to know, how are things? How's the business here in Maine going? What's going on with Hancock Lumber? I'd love to hear a little bit about that.
Sure. Business is good. Business is good. I think, obviously, everybody in our industry went through quite a ride over the course of the last 10 years when the housing market collapsed and the mortgage markets collapsed. And it was probably a lot of work for everybody in the industry to kind of get repositioned to do well in the new economy. But most everybody did. We did. And now housing starts are growing again, and business is good.
No, that's great. Well, you have one of the six-generation family business, right? I mean, that's unheard of. 1848. Am I reading that correctly?
Yeah, you are reading that correctly.
Wow. So, you know, nothing's changed, of course, in since then. Have the same thing. But, you know, I mean, that's really a testament to the family, keeping the business and keeping it moving. What do you see as being the internal, you know, reason for that staying the way it has?
Well, the first thing I always tell people is to have a six-generation family business, the first key ingredient is you have to have started a really long time ago.
That's true.
You know, and then you need a lot of luck, and you need to be connected to a lot of really good people. But we've been fortunate that way, and the company's, as you say, been in business uninterrupted since prior to the Civil War. And typically when you look around the country at the oldest family businesses in America, a lot of them are in the Northeast, where America started. Makes sense. And
yes,
a lot
of
them are in traditional industries like agriculture or forest products or farming, things like that. So we've been doing this for a while.
Yeah, no question about it. And the leadership methods that we're going to talk a little about leadership today. But leadership's changed over the years, hasn't it? And what is, we talk about millennials, you know, not staying as long with organizations, and or just the way people expect to be treated in organizations has really changed. Obviously, you've seen that.
Yeah, I think we're on the cusp of a pretty significant leadership revolution. And obviously sometimes it's difficult to talk about topics like that with broad strokes, because leadership is unique to each person and each organization, and it has to fit and be authentic. But having said that, I think that a transition is taking place globally from the institution holding all the cards or all the power, whether it's the government or the church or the corporation, towards a organizational structure where the individual participants, the individual members of the organization, are going to increasingly want to hold more power. And I think organizations that fight that try to resist and keep everything close to the center are going to, over time, probably struggle a bit more than organizations that are inclined to want to put more power out with the people who are actually doing the work.
Well, you know, and we're talking with Kevin Hancock, president of Hancock Lumber, and he has a book, Not For Sale. You know, we find that certainly individuals today have a more belief in experience, right? And learning and gaining experience more than necessarily working for an organization. They want to gain experience. They want to gain knowledge. They want to be able to transfer that knowledge from one person to another, and they want to know that the organization is doing the right thing, right? I mean, that's really where we're seeing it going from our aspect. Certainly the same thing you're seeing. How do leaders start, and as we get ready to start talking about your book, how does the leaders start really shifting that mindset?
Well, I think it starts with seeing people as being important, seeing an organization as being about people. And I've just been lucky that way because it's how I'm wired. Like when I travel around our company to mills and stores, we're in an industry that's very capital intensive. We have lots of machinery, vehicles, building, inventory, and so forth. But for me, when I travel around the company, that's not really what I see or what catches my attention. I see people. And I don't see employees to take that one step further. I see people, human beings, who have jobs. And I just think it's important for leaders to see the people that are on their team as individuals who have a job, but that job does not even make up, of course, the totality of who that individual is. It's one part of their life. And I think it's also important to really think about and talk about within an organization the non-economic reasons, really what you were referring to, the non-economic reasons why people work. Because if it's healthy, I think, to make a list of reasons why people have a job, and you can kind of put them in two buckets. There are economic reasons, and those are pretty straightforward, and then there are non-economic reasons. And I think it's important to think about and talk about and work on the non-economic reasons why work can be valuable and why people would want to work and be part of a team or an organization.
Well, you know, most surveys still say that financial reason for being hired, once you've reached a point of a certain threshold, right, that threshold of, okay, I can pay my bills and I can do what I need to do financially and have a life, then the importance of financial really starts dropping in the importance level. And most surveys will say it's anywhere between, oh, sixth or seventh on the list, right, in terms of importance, other than, accomplishment, feeling of culture, feeling of being, all those other things that we're talking about here today. But you do have to have the financial foundation to start with. You can't not have that. And matter of fact, last
Correct.
Week we were just talking with another gentleman, Louis Efron, and he's we just had him on last week as a guest, and he talked about the fact that he talks about passion, right? Passion in the industry. It's great to have passion, but and you need to get to the point of that. But he had his passion, and then he realized he couldn't financially make it. So he did things to grow to the point where he could then go do his passion. And it changed over time. And that's no different than most people, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how most people are. You have a foundation, you build from there.
Agreed. No, agreed. And you, you definitely have to pay attention, significant attention, in listening and interest in the economic reasons why people work as well. And you've got to really look at the market, and you've got to create opportunities for people to grow income and help them see those opportunities and have benefits packages that are meaningful and valuable. All of those ingredients are critical. But then, as you well know, that in and of itself is not even enough, because you have to do those things. It's like the ante to the game. But then to really create top-performing teams, I think it's got to be about meaning as well. So financial and non-financial are reasons for working are both important and powerful.
Well, you know, you said a key word, and I'm going to repeat it again. You said listen. Not a lot of leaders do a lot of listening. Good leaders do. At least this is my take on it, and I'd love to hear your mm-hmm. take on it. But just walking around and talking to the team and not sitting in the office, we call it the ivory tower type leadership, that's really, it's never really changed from importance, but today it's more important than ever. Would you agree?
I would totally agree, and it's that topic is really at the essence of what my book's about. So in and to some degree, I stumbled onto this. In 2010, I acquired a rare voice disorder called spasmodic dysphonia, which you might or might not notice today, but it can get really bad. Essentially, what happens, it's neurological, is when you go to speak, the muscles around your throat and voice system contract and squeeze, and I feel like I'm being strangled, and within just a couple sentences, I run out of air, and it can get so bad that at times you could be sitting right beside me and you would barely hear me. So in 2010, kind of at the peak of the housing collapse, I found myself being responsible for helping to run a company and not having consistent use of my voice. I couldn't talk all the time. And it was really interesting to come to terms with that and to figure out some different strategies for leading, which started connecting to what you do when you can't talk, which is you listen. Yeah. And you get really good at asking questions.
Do you find that it's made you a better leader?
Yes. Without question, it has made me a better leader, I feel, because I'm, well, this is the thing that's different from what we've been taught. I've really come to believe, as a result of how I responded to that voice disorder, that leadership in the Aquarian age is about doing less, not more. It's about sharing the stage and creating a bigger platform for all the voices in the organization to become stronger. And I don't know if I would have learned that lesson if I hadn't lost the consistent use of my own voice, but having lost the consistent use of my voice and stumbled on some strategies for leading differently, I got looking around at what was happening, and I was like, oh, this works better anyway.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, I mean, do you now find that you are, as we are sharing with the book, sharing that with your team and getting them to listen more?
Yes, for sure. Especially with our leadership team, our managers and our supervisors. There's that old saying that the customer comes first, and I totally get that saying, but I say the customer comes a very close second, and that the people who are actually going to serve the customer, take care of the customer, make the products for the customer, they come first. And if the leaders within an organization listen to and empower the people who are going to care for the customer, those people will figure out how to take great care of the customer. So you take great care of the customer by focusing on the people who are going to care for them.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I mean, good organizations, it really starts with the people anyways, right at the beginning, right? I mean, because if you don't have the right people in the right place at the right time doing the right things, you can have great customers come in, but they're not getting the great service, or they're not getting the information they need. Or, I mean, at the bottom line, you're right. It is about the employees at the end of the day. And keeping them engaged, keeping them focused on doing the right thing every day is an everyday process. It's not just a once-a-week leadership meeting process.
No, that's exactly right. So what I think about now is essentially this question. Wouldn't an organization where everybody led, where everybody felt that their voice mattered and was powerful, wouldn't an organization like that in the long run outperform organizations where just a few people lead or hold all the power? So the real question is, how do you come up with some authentic strategies that help everybody feel like it's safe
keyword,
to say what they think and to talk about what they're experiencing? That's the real trick.
Well, safe is an interesting word, right? Because it conjures up a core of someone, someone's core, where they're saying, okay, I'm not going to lose my job if I say something. I'm not going to, because people get afraid that if they lose the job, then that's their livelihood, and then they're in real trouble. And if, especially here in the great state of Maine, with only 1.3 million people, then you probably know one of everyone you know around here. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, 2 degrees of separation, not three. It could be really detrimental to the career. So how do you create that foundational part of getting people to really feel safe? Because that takes work.
Right. It does take work, and I think it has to start with the top leaders in the organization. So I've, when I was younger, I used to spend a lot of time as a manager and a leader worrying about what everyone else needed to do differently. And things only started to flip for me when I essentially gave that up and started putting most of my energy on what I needed to do differently. And it's that whole notion of be the change you want to see in others, that famous Gandhi quote. So I, what I started thinking about is if I wanted the organization to be a safe place for everyone to say what they thought, step number one was I had to pay attention to how I reacted when people said what they thought, especially if it wasn't exactly what I thought. And again, that takes restraint, because I think leaders or managers often feel like when someone says something, if it doesn't match what you're thinking, your job is to re-explain it or correct them or to educate them. But what we started experimenting with and have really latched on to is, no, that's not the purpose of having a conversation. The purpose of a conversation is not actually to judge a response or a perspective at all. It's just to create an environment where everybody would actually say what they really see from their position in the organization. And the power comes from knowing what people are experiencing, and judging it or correcting it is not the primary goal of a conversation.
That's going to be a lot for some leaders to swallow, because a lot of leaders believe that if you're not toeing the line, right, if you're not believing in the mission, the focus, the culture as it is, then you're not aligned with the organization. So how do you make that shift?
It takes a lot of time and patience and consistency, I think, to tip an organization so that it functions that way. And every day you've got to get up again and keep working at it. But and what we have tried to do is build in some mechanisms that make the voice of the employee strong. So, for example, one of our favorite core mechanisms is the annual best places to work in Maine survey. We've been fortunate now to be a best place to work in Maine 2 years in a row. We're the only forest products company on the list. You don't normally see retailers on the list. We are. You don't normally see manufacturers on the list. We are. And we've taken a lot of pride in having a lumber company be a best place to work. But having said that, what we are really after with best places to work is the annual engagement survey. So once a year, every employee in our company, and the participation rate is over 95%, takes that third party confidential survey, and then we're able to roll that data up by location, mill or store. And we've now been at this for about a half a decade. So you've got trends that emerge in how the people who work at the company are experiencing the company and defining engagement for themselves. And we've actually gotten to the point where for our managers, the single biggest data point of the year is not a financial statement. It's not a productivity goal. I mean, the single biggest point would be safety metrics. But beyond that, the single biggest metric in the whole company is the employee engagement feedback survey, where we see, in their own words, what's getting better, what's not getting better, and how they're experiencing the organization.
We're talking with Kevin Hancock, president of Hancock Lumber. We're talking about his book, Not For Sale. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, and we will be right back. If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
They were a marching band with a plan to steal their rival mascot's costume. Stealth would be critical. I said stealth was critical. They searched each room until there it was, the precious mascot in a glass case. They ran toward the exit when suddenly the theft was covered thanks to a farmer's agent. Marching Bandits, May 4th, 2015. Talk to farmers. We know a thing or two because we've seen a thing or two.
We are farmers. Bum, 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 bum.
Hi. This is Carfax. You already say, show me the Carfax. But now you can say, show me millions of used cars for sale at the all-new Carfax.com, where now you can search with the power of Carfax. Want cars with no accidents reported? You got them. Used cars that are well-maintained? You can find those too. Even one-owner cars are just a click away. Plus, we're the only site where you get a free Carfax report with every car for sale. So, find the cars you want, avoid the ones you don't. Start your used car search at Carfax.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by cmacareer.com. And today we're talking with Kevin Hancock, president of Hancock Lumber, and his new book, Not For Sale, Finding Center in the Land of Crazy Horse. Well, that's an interesting title there, Kevin. Share where you got the title from first, and then we'll certainly talk about the interior here of the book.
Yeah, the title, we have some fun with the title because a lot of people see the book and they say, oh, that's so nice, it's free. And I say, no, that's the title of the book. It's not for sale. So the book chronicles a series of trips that I ended up taking to the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in the southwest corner of South Dakota, starting in the fall of 2012. And I started going there after I lost my voice as a way to kind of do something just for me outside of my roles. I've always loved the American West, and I've always loved American history. I used to teach American history before I came to work at Hancock Lumber, and I was particularly interested in the second half of the 19th century when America's Western expansion ran into the Plains Indians. And I was in an airport in August of 2012 and picked up a National Geographic, and the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation was on the cover. And it's kind of the poster child for big, disenfranchised, statistically challenged Indian reservations in the West. And I said to my wife, Allison, I'm going to go there. I want to see what life is like there today. And I got out there, and I just really got caught up by the place, the beauty of the place, the people that lived there, the history, the kind of terrible set of cards they were dealt and are still dealing with. And the title really is symbolic of a couple things. One, for me, it was a chance to express myself beyond my role. So it's like I'm not for sale, and that, yeah, I have a role of running a company, and that's my job, and I care about it, but it's not the totality of who I am. So that was one part of Not For Sale. And then the second part of Not For Sale is This is a group, a community on the reservation that is also not for sale. So in 1980, the Lakota ended up in the Supreme Court, who ruled that their Fifth Amendment rights had been violated when their land was taken back in the 1870s without just compensation. And the Supreme Court tabulated, went back and calculated the value of the land and awarded them the money. And the Lakota said, no, you don't understand, our land's not for sale. And they refused to take the money, which still sits in trust to this day. It's now well over $1 billion. So they weren't for sale. I wasn't for sale. So that was kind of the impetus for the title.
Interesting. Well, you know, I saw there's an article that you had provided from the NLRA magazine, which talks about a path to change. Kevin Hancock details his visits to the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation with lessons for business. I think what we're talking about today is exactly what are those lessons, right? How does the book take you to understanding that these lessons can be applied to business? You know, we talked about in the first segment of this a lot about the changing of leadership. And so this book is like a little bit of a roadmap, right? A little bit of a lessons that you can learn to have you be a better leader, to have you be a stronger business owner or stronger HR professional or just professional in general. How do you see the book, you know, catapulting that individual who reads it forward?
Right. Yeah, so the book travels back and forth between the reservation and Maine, where I'm learning about their community, learning about their challenges, trying to kind of find my own voice, and then trying to come back to Maine within my roles and incorporate some of the things I'm thinking about. And so And what really struck me is how many common themes there were. So one of the themes that really caught my attention is the notion that that leaders often overreach. They go too far, and they get too greedy, and it does eventually implode. So I'm out there looking at this tribe, now the Oglala Sioux tribe, on the reservation and traveling around the land they used to own and that we had to have or take from them because gold was discovered back in the 1870s in the Black Hills, and it wasn't necessary. It was overreaching because the biggest thing you notice when you drive around the land they used to own today is it's empty. There's nobody there.
That's interesting.
There's nobody there. So this land we had to have because there was gold, was an example of overreaching, and overreaching has consequences. The Lakota refer to gold, used to refer to gold as the yellow metal that makes the white men crazy. And there was overreaching there. And then the second thing that really caught my attention there is it's now a community for which the center, the government, it's probably the most government-centric community you could find in America today. Everything that people have economically either comes from the federal government or the tribal government through the federal government. The center has all the power, and the people that live there feel like they don't have a voice. So I was kind of there trying to regain my own voice in a place where, for a very different set of reasons, people feel like they don't have a voice. And I was comparing that to their structure, the Lakota organizational structure, before they were colonized and forced onto the reservations, and it was the total opposite. So in the 1860s and 70s, the federal government, Washington, the Great Father, would send peace negotiators out onto the plains, and they'd show up and they'd say, take me to your leader. And the Lakota would say, well, I don't even know what you're talking about, because they had a very decentralized structure where all the power went to the individual. And the center was hard to even find. And back in that period where the individual was powerful, the tribe was powerful. So it was a bit like Rudyard Kipling's The Jungle Book. The strength of the pack is the wolf. And if every wolf is strong, then the pack is strong. So then coming back to Hancock Lumber and thinking about organizational leadership here, it was like, well, I don't have consistent use of my voice, which shortly thereafter I came to see as an opportunity, not a problem, and said, well, what if we could help create an environment where everybody felt like their voice was strong? Wouldn't that be a more spiritually powerful organization, and wouldn't it produce a better result? So I kept finding all these parallels coming back and forth, and the book really follows that story as it unfolds.
We have over 400 people at Hancock Lumber.
Correct.
So, you know, obviously structure's important from a standpoint of safety, important from a retail structure and so forth. How do you merge the concept of decentralized individual control with the reality of business, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is the structural control of a store or a mill or lumber in general. How do you merge those two together? Because I think the essence of the book is how that can still happen in any organization, right? In any, because I can see, if you get lumber, if you get any industry, there's typically some sort, even if it's a flat line, there's still a structure of mm-hmm. some sort. So how do you merge those two together?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And obviously it's critical that you merge the two together, because it takes a balance of both. So I think you have to talk about it a lot, and you have to work on it a lot. I think it starts with a set of values that get talked about a lot, that everybody gets to talk about, that kind of drive decision-making, so that as people are making all the decisions they have to make during the course of a day, they've got values that help guide those decisions. And then definitely there's still a really important place for policy, procedure, documented visual systems and best practices. Those things don't restrict individual freedom. They enhance it. And you just have to talk about that idea. You know, the concept of having a best practice for how we do something is not designed to limit people's creativity or freedom. It's actually designed to increase it by making sure that the core systems are accurate, so that people have less wasted time, less time involved in rework, and less time involved in messes and complications, and more time for creativity and growth and all of those things.
We're talking with Kevin Hancock, president of Hancock Lumber, and of course we're talking about his book, Not For Sale. You know, as you went through the book and you started writing it, and you saw the parallels between the reservation and the industry, was there a point you said, geez, I wonder if this is actually going to work? Was there a point where you started, because I'm sure there was pushback. I mean, it'd be hard to believe that everybody just jumped on board immediately.
The big thing I struggled with, it was interesting to see the book unfold, because I actually at first I didn't set out to write a book. I didn't go to Pine Ridge to write a book. I didn't go there to rethink management. I went there because I wanted to do something just for me, a bit outside my normal roles. And I was keeping a journal at the time. And I got back on the plane after my first trip, and I looked at what I'd written, and I was really revisiting, like, how the place had caught me. And I'd written like 70 or 80 pages in my journal, and I was like, oh my God, I'm going to go back and I'm going to keep writing. And pretty soon a story unfolded. But this book was playing itself out as I was living it. Like, I'd probably written three quarters of the book before I even knew the ending, because each trip was an independent experience into and of itself. But when it all came together, it didn't give me a lot of fear, because the core concepts of celebrating the individual, of making every voice matter, I was like, who wouldn't agree with that? Philosophically, who wouldn't think that would be better if you could do it? And for me, somewhat, it was a necessity as well, because my voice, which you might be skeptical of listening to me today, because my voice right now is about as good as
No, I've heard you speak before. I understand.
But there are, like I said, there are lots of times where I really can't talk very much. And so for me, it was a it was a bit of a necessity as well to rethink what a leader did and didn't do.
When you were at the reservation and talking to the group of Indians, were there wisdom or their counsel in terms of talking with you when you had these conversations with them? Do they share how they came about doing this, or was it because it's been so long in their tradition? How did you? I guess the question is really, how did you grasp those concepts or take away from it, since to them it's just everyday life?
Right. It was more just listening to people there talk about their culture and their values. So in Lakota spirituality, for example, there are seven sacred rites, and one of them, probably the one people would most know or remember, is the vision quest. It's called, in Lakota, they say, Hamblate Chia, which translated means to cry for a vision. And in the vision quest rite, what would happen is young people coming of age or adults at critical points in their lives would leave the tribe, sequester themselves alone in nature without any food or water or possessions for the purpose of seeking a vision. And that was really to cry for a vision is what it means. And it was really to kind of understand what inspires you, what excites you, and then you are expected to come back to your tribe, share that vision, and live your life in accordance with that path or those principles or that type of activity. And again, the notion was healthy individuals create a healthy tribe. And I had I have this feeling, and it really sunk in once I lost my voice, that work is getting out of balance, that we live, that there is a busyness bubble that is consuming this country. And that we live in a 24/7 internet wired bigger, better, more, measure everything, go, go, go world, where no matter what you do, what time you start, what time you finish, or how productive you are, it's not enough. And that people, in subtle ways, are losing balance. And they feel it, you know. It's a time of productivity growth and business improvements, but I think lots of people, in a way, they can't totally put their finger on it. Like, something's not quite right, something's missing. And I think the work has gotten a little bit out of balance. So one of the missions I really feel called to is this notion of putting the work back in its place, where it is really important. We are really committed, but it's not going to be all-consuming. We're going to restore some balance to people's lives.
We're talking with Kevin Hancock, president of Hancock Lumber. We're talking about his book, Not For Sale. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on Newstalk WLOB, and we will be right back.
Dale Carnegie Training specializes in building high-performing individuals and teams, and Dale Carnegie Maine provides public courses that do just that.
Sign up for courses starting February 1st with the Dale Carnegie Sales Training Course, February 5th, How to Cold Call, February 23rd, High Impact Presentations, February 25th, in Bangor and Portland, the Dale Carnegie Training Course. To sign up, go to maine.dalecarnegie.com or call 775-3253.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business, and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis, as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
Guys, when you buy your clothes at DXL, you look good. But you feel like a rock star. So if you want to look and feel like a... You'll find all the brands you love, waist size 38 and up, all in one awesome store. DXL. You're looking good. Right now, Harbor Bay long sleeve tees are just $29.99 each when you buy two or more.
You make the decision to buy the home, then you're faced with what's next? What do we do?
We started at Realtor.com.
Realtor.com gave us a lot more current information.
Listings are pulled directly from the MLS every 15 minutes.
Once you've gone through all of that, the Realtor makes it happen.
We worked with the Realtor that really knew the area.
And he knew the market.
When you have someone who has the expertise, it makes it so much easier.
Realtor.com and Realtors. Together, we make home happen. Realtors are members of the National Association of Realtors.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. And today we've been talking with Kevin Hancock. He's the president of Hancock Lumber. And he has a book, and it's called Not For Sale. And Kevin, we've been talking about in this last segment, just before we went to break, we talked a little bit about work being and business being ever-consuming. Well, the reality is that yes, it probably is. And I'll be one to say that I'm definitely one that gets consumed in my work. I guess the real question, because of the internet and because you're expected to have answers so quickly and business is expected and clients expected and customers expected, they don't expect a lot of time anymore because the attention span is, you know, that nowadays. Or they move on. They move to other places. How do we actually put work back in its place when it could be harmful in some ways from a business perspective?
Someone once said all things are created twice, first in your head, first in someone's head, and then in real life. So I think it starts with an idea, you know, and it's just not a notion that gets talked about much, really, when you look around. It is let's put more balance back into our lives. So we do, how we've gone about it is we do, like many companies who manufacture, a lot of work with lean manufacturing, process improvement, Six Sigma efficiency, productivity gains. And they're real and significant and consistent, across time. So then it's just about, well, what about this idea? What if we used some of the productivity gains to work more? We'll make more widgets. We'll take more orders. We'll ship more stuff. But what if we used some of the time created by those productivity gains to just plain work less?
Well, there's a concept.
There's a concept. And work less and work more accurately. So we started looking at the average work week of our employee, the people on our team who are paid by the hour. And the average work week was about 48 hours. And we said, well, what if we could, over time, reduce that to around 40? Right now we're averaging 41. And find new financial incentives that would allow people to continue to see income growth. Because you have to, for that to work, you've got to attack both ends of that. Because if you think about a really interesting question is, why do people work overtime?
Time and a half.
Right. So you've got that part of it. And then on the company's side, why do people work overtime? Well, probably because there's a lot of inefficiency and mistakes and waste, and it takes a long time to do it. But it's not really optimal. It's not really optimal. So we created a performance incentive plan we call Performance Gold, where everybody in the company can earn more money now, not based on working longer, but based on us becoming more, essentially more accurate, whether it's with respect to safety or quality or efficiency. And that as those metrics improve, that's how people make more money. That and looking at base pay rates. In our industry, traditionally, people's base pay rates were probably drifted towards the lower end of the scale, but you came out okay at the end of the week because you worked 60 hours or 65 hours, and that's just what everybody did. And that model really hadn't been rethought in quite some time, but we've been thinking about it and working on it. And what we've found, I guess, is not surprising. People like it better. You know, so a lot of people at our company now are working 4 10-hour days. So they now have 3 days that they can reinvest their energy into something else that attracts their attention. I'm probably the only person that reinvested would have chosen to reinvest it in the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. But as I think about now and say to people, what's your Pine Ridge? You know, what is it outside of work that really, really calls to you? And if we can put the work back in its place a little bit, and everybody has more energy and time to reinvest in something else, that's powerful.
Well, you know, when you're really looking at this, there is an importance of you're doing it not only for yourself, the organization, but you're doing it for others, right? There is a mindset of saying, and you've said it kind of in what you're talking about, is about doing this so that there's a better good for everyone, not just a better good for the company or the organization or even yourself, right? Is a better good for others, and that feeds very well in today's mindset, right? For culture and for doing the right thing.
It totally does. I've got a hand-drawn triangle on one of those big post-it notes in our conference room office that has the employee, the people that work at the company on the top of that triangle. And if you figure out how to help make work better for them, they will figure out how to help make the experience better for the customer. And if both the employee and the customer are having a better experience, chances are the company's going to benefit from that. But it doesn't start by thinking about the company. It starts by thinking about the people that work there and then figuring out how to take great care of the customer. And that third leg of the stool or the triangle, the company will take care of itself if you do a great job in those other two areas, I think.
No, I think there's no question about that. Do you find that some of the leaders, when they really think about this and they say, yes, it's a great idea to do that, what are some of the resistance factors you went up against, right? What were some of the traditional thought processes that some leaders initially may have had some hard time to get over? And the reason I ask that is because, you know, when change is hard for anyone. Let's be honest about that. Change is one of the most difficult things anybody goes through. And when you've had success, you tend to do what you do every bit the same way, because why would you change? It was successful. So talk to me a little bit about some of that resistance and how you overcame that, because I think it's an important part for the audience to understand that there's going to be resistance and how you make it so that they understand how to get through that.
Yep. Well, first of all, I do think by and large, I'm really lucky. Our leaders at Hancock Lumber have been very receptive to this set of ideas. But I think to the extent there's a fear, I think it's the fear of letting go of all the control that you've got. And that traditional model of the manager holding all the information, all the decision-making opportunities, there's control that goes with that. And letting go of that and not really being sure of what's going to replace that, I think is scary for people. And I think, you know, somewhat for good reason, too, because they just want to do it. People want to do a good job. So they worry that things will go sideways or go off the rails if they let go too much. So it just you just try to get people to do it little by little. And as I say, you're not really giving up any power or control. You know, you're just letting things sit a little bit more to see what responsibility people will take and run with, and you can celebrate that. And then what things aren't being grabbed or picked up that need to be, and then you can help bring people's attention back to that. It's just a little bit. It's about relaxing. It'll all play itself out if you're patient.
You know, this has obviously been a big turning point in your life. Can you share with the audience maybe your personal takeaways and what maybe they can have a takeaway from you today as we get ready to wrap up the show in the last 3 minutes here?
Yeah, my big personal takeaway is that we all need to serve ourselves and that it's really easy, and that's counterintuitive because we've been brought up in a culture that's sacrifice, don't worry about you, take care of everybody else. And that's noble, and I get it, and it works to a point. But at the end of the day, each individual's here to live a life, and each individual has to stay focused on the life they want to live and be intentional. Because it's really easy in this day and age to just get caught up in the grind and the churn and the busyness. And you wake up and you're at the end of a life and you realize you've not really been intentional. One of the things I talk about in my book is the why this fascination with zombie genre movies and shows today. Because whenever I come flip the stations and I come across one, I watch for 2 minutes and I'm like, I don't get it. This is so boring. But what I suggest in my book is that I think on a deep-seated level that we have not touched base with yet, a lot of us are afraid we're becoming one. And the big learning for me is to transcend that and to serve yourself, to think about it as being okay to serve yourself, and to realize that in the long run, the more you serve yourself, the more value you will be to others.
Do you have a takeaway for an organization that really thinks about it, of putting this in place?
Yes, I think you think about celebrating the power of the individual, and that you flip leadership inside out and start thinking about quite possibly the key leadership skill in the Aquarian age is actually restraint. It's holding the power and not using it. As I say, the boss gets first dibs on all the work, whether you're running a church or a company or a country.
Kevin, where's the best place for people to get your book?
So the book's for sale.
For sale!
In bookstores throughout Maine. It's also available on Amazon. But the best place to order the book is at www.kevindhancock.com. www.kevindhancock.com. I see all the orders that come in on that site, and I sign all those books personally.
Kevin, I want to thank you very much for being on the show today. Your book, Not For Sale, is going to be certainly on the HR Power Hour website right after the show, along with your podcast of this great show. I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour on Newstalk WLOB. And now your HR tip of the week. According to TrendHR.com, there are three essential behaviors to look for in team members. First, curiosity, defined as the strong desire to know and learn something. Second, collaboration, a person's willingness and desire to work efficiently and effectively with others. And then third, commitment. New ideas, wonderful plans, and brilliant strategies only work if every member of the team is committed to seeing things through. That's your HR tip of the week. Thank you for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 1310 a.m. or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.